57 years, she's homeless.
Homeless?
She's homeless, yes, she's homeless, and I said that was setting a good example for the rest of us. Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, and it wouldn't hurt for, I wouldn't, it'd probably do me good to be out under the bridge for a while.
So sometime ago, I heard that she was having health problems.
But Elena had back surgery, and it has helped a lot, she said. So she's much better, and I'll see her, I'm going upstairs this week. And her brother Harry is a great guy, but he's terminally ill with cancer, and that's one of the things that is tying her to Grand Pass. We started 26 weeks ago in the clean pages of the Old Testament. I suppose now those pages aren't clean anymore. I'm not going to ask about Leviticus or Numbers or any of those parts of the Bible that were in the clean pages, but 26 weeks is a long time, and we started with Ezekiel, if you remember, way back there, about 6 months ago. This week, as I was reading this, the secular history of what's going on, it gets complicated in a hurry. Walter Kaiser is very good. Generally, his history of Israel, you can look on the internet. Some Bibles will have a section in between the Old Testament and the New Testament that's called the intertestamental period. And I gave you today Ray Stedman's very helpful notes called The 400 Silent Years. And they're very similar to a little book by Harry Ironside that you can get that goes a little bit into the history of these turbulent years between Malachi and Matthew, of approximately 400 years. Let me give you a broad overview and hope to not make too many mistakes, and some of you know more than I do, so you can speak up. Let's go back to for a general overview, let's start at Solomon, which if you want, that's like about 1000 B.C., and you remember that the kingdom divided at the death of Solomon into two parts because of the dispute between Rehoboam and Jeroboam, and the 10 northern tribes rebelled and set up an independent kingdom in the north with separate sanctuaries at Dan and Bethel, where they erected golden calves and replaced the Levitical priesthood, and became an independent kingdom at the division of the land, with about 20 kings that follow in the line of Jeroboam, all bad kings, every one of them. And we have the prophets Elijah and others that speak to that northern kingdom. And the southern kingdom, we have about the same number of kings. That's Judah and Benjamin. They have the temple in Jerusalem. Most of the loyal Levitical priests have fled to Jerusalem. And representatives of all of the tribes who have a relationship with Yahweh have pretty much moved to Jerusalem. All 12 tribes are living in Jerusalem and more or less faithful to the God of Israel at Jerusalem. So the decline of the two southern tribes is somewhat slower. We did not here cover the book of Isaiah, which is actually in the middle of the Bible, and I've been teaching Isaiah down in San Jose this year. And I was struck again with Isaiah's prophecies about Babylon. Isaiah, 700 B.C. about, has a great deal to say about Babylon. And at the time he wrote, Babylon was not a major power in the world. Assyria was the major power. Assyria came in, decimated the 10 northern tribes and carried them away during Isaiah's lifetime. In 722, the 10 northern tribes were taken out of the land. And Sennacherib and the Assyrians imported a bunch of foreigners to occupy the land. These people intermarried with the Jews that remained and became the Samaritans, remember? Sennacherib and his army came down and besieged Judah, and he came and besieged Jerusalem and threatened Jerusalem. And Hezekiah and Isaiah got together and took this threatening letter into the temple before God and prayed about it. And God turned away the army of the Assyrians that very day, turned them away, sent them home, and then that night, 176 Assyrians were killed. And then, as the Bible says cryptically, and when they woke up in the morning, behold, all of them were dead. with some kind of a plague or disaster, God struck down the whole Assyrian army, and Sennacherib went home, and a few years later, his sons killed him. And that marked a very sharp decline of the Assyrian Empire, which up until then had been lawless and powerful over the whole region. And now suddenly Babylon comes up into power. quickly and suddenly. You remember Hezekiah made a bad mistake in Isaiah's time. He had a bad mistake in having the ambassadors from Babylon come over, thinking he might make a favorable alliance, and he showed them all his military trophies, his tanks and his jet airplanes and his phaser weapons and the gold and silver in the temple. And that, of course, provoked them to covet the vast amount of gold and silver that were in the temple. But what Isaiah says, Isaiah predicts the rise of Babylon. He predicts the Babylonian captivity that the Jews are going to end up there for 70 years. He predicts their return, and he names the king who's going to send them back, and that king is Cyrus. Calls him by name before he's ever born. Cyrus is called the servant of God. He's described in great detail, and Cyrus is going to be the Persian king who conquers Babylon. And so it's remarkable how much way ahead of time God predicted the whole Babylonian captivity, which is, we've been looking at here. And it all came to pass. When we started Ezekiel, remember we're right at the end of existence of the two southern tribes, and Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians are the major threat from the east. And they come in a series of raids, and 605 taking Daniel and the three boys off into Babylon into captivity where they lived out the rest of their lives, Daniel becoming a high official in the court of the king Nebuchadnezzar and the subsequent kings of Babylon, remember that. A few years later, Nebuchadnezzar comes in and very much provoked by the rebellions of the Jews in Jerusalem and their unwillingness to pay tribute and their entangling alliances with the Egyptians and so forth. And God hauls off Ezekiel, our young prophet friend, not a gray-haired old man, but 25 years old, and 10,000 of the Jews, and they spend the next 70 years in Babylon. If you think about that, if you think about the decline that's going on in Isaiah's day is predicted. The prophets are urging the people to turn around, but by the time of the Babylonian captivity, we have people who are stubborn, indifferent to God, apathetic, not listening, not paying attention, except for very few. Remember that? Downhill. Could have turned around. There are a few kings that are good, and they do reforms, but the reforms are always too little, too late. Little minor course corrections that don't fix the overall downward decline of Israel's a sad story. And at the Babylonian captivity, we have the population of Jerusalem mostly destroyed, and most of the Jews destroyed, and only a small number carried off into captivity in Babylon. Suppose God was to come into our area today and nuke us and allow a few of us to survive, but we had to go live 70 years in Kansas City, say, for example. And we couldn't come back here. And we'd go off to Kansas City, and those of us who were older would die. We'd have children and grandchildren. And at the end of 70 years, our grandchildren would get the news that they could move back to what was left of Palo Alto. And they wouldn't have known anything about Palo Alto except old postcards and maybe a few old maps, and Palo Alto's in ruins, and now you've got to persuade the loyal Christians in Kansas City that their homeland is Palo Alto, so would they come back here and start over again? Plow land and raise cattle and sheep and so on. Well, you can see that, in a way, that this is a very sad period of time for God to essentially eradicate a whole generation of his people, except for a remnant, and then wait about 70 years, about two generations before he does the restoring work. And that we saw that in Ezekiel. Remember in Ezekiel that God said, I'm going to send you to speak to these people, and they're not going to believe you, so don't be bothered by their lack of response to you. And they're not even going to believe that Jerusalem's going to be destroyed until it's destroyed. And then they'll finally get the message later on, and then you can go do other things. And, oh, by the way, your wife's going to die on the day Jerusalem is destroyed, but I don't want you weeping over that. Remember all that with Ezekiel? And so you've got the remnant, the people that ought to be grateful that their lives were saved, that they were going to have safety in Babylon, weren't exactly glad. We probably would grumble if we had to go to Kansas City for 70 years and live there. Kansas City's a nice town now, by the way. I could have picked St. Louis or Winnemucca, but I just picked Kansas City.
Brings back the point, Lambert, God doesn't have grandchildren.
God does not have grandchildren. He has only sons and daughters. And throughout this whole time period, when you look at the big picture, that doesn't take into account the fact that there are many individuals who have a good relationship with God, who are godly, who are God-fearing, and when they die, they go to be with the Lord. The overall, the big picture isn't good, but that doesn't negate the lives, the quality of lives of the remnant, of the believing remnant in the land. So that always means God does not leave himself without a good, strong remnant.
So you want to.
What's the difference between a son and a grandchild? Well, that God raises his sons personally, individually, one at a time, not through just your parents or your grandparents. That kind of help there? You feel like you're being treated personally by God, that he treats you as a son or a daughter and gives you personal hands-on care and personal hands-on discipline. None of you have had to have any of that from the Lord, but God's a personal intimate God. That it comes up all the time. I write letters to Muslims, and Allah is not a personal God. So that one of the most good ways to start a conversation with a Muslim is to talk about the fact the God of the Bible is the covenant-making personal God who values relationships. Again and again through this, our whole time together, we've seen that it comes right back that God hates hypocrisy. He hates religious formalism, ceremony, self-righteousness is the default that we default to, that what God wants is intimacy and relationship, quality relationship. That's what we want with each other. Well, that's what God wants with us. We went through all of Ezekiel together, and you remember the last part of Ezekiel has that tremendously good news of the long-term future of Israel, that God would bring them back eventually. We had the vision of the Valley of Dry Bones and God's unhappiness at all the false shepherds, that he himself would come and be their shepherd, that there would be a great last war in the Middle East, that there would be a new temple built, a millennial temple that comes at the end. So the last chapters of Ezekiel have this spectacular picture of the long-term future of Israel, and we looked at that, and we can see that that hadn't happened yet. And then we went to Daniel. More familiar book, this exciting story of three young boys who determined to walk with God in a pagan land under Nebuchadnezzar and the powerful gods of Persia, and not compromise, and how they were protected by God, burning fiery furnace, and Daniel in the lion's den. And in Daniel, we found that there were some incredible prophetic passages, the famous passage of the 70 weeks of Daniel, which predicted that the future of Israel would run on a time scale of 70 weeks of years. Very enigmatic, difficult section of scripture that our interpretation was that there is yet one more week to run of those 70 weeks. 69 weeks ended with the crucifixion of Jesus, but the 70th week would be the final week in which Israel's future is all restored. And we had the long section in there that predicted the history of Babylon and the history of the Jews after the fall of the Babylonian kingdom. Babylon did not last very long. It lasted about 70 years. Nebuchadnezzar was the great powerful king. Kings that came after him were weak. The last king that was of the king of note was Belshazzar, who was the co-regent with Nabonidus. Nabonidus was out of town most of the time. Belshazzar was home partying. And we had Belshazzar's feast in the great palace at Babylon, which the Marine Corps has now as their headquarters, in the big banquet room of Nebuchadnezzar. Belshazzar had his big feast there, and the handwriting was on the wall, and that Daniel was brought in as a tottering old man and interpreted the handwriting and told Belshazzar his time was up. And that very night, the Medes and the Persians under Cyrus and Darius came through the riverbed under the walls of the city and destroyed the government, not the city, but took Belshazzar out, and that began the Persian Empire. So we got that, and we got that Daniel had already predicted this whole course of history after that. Daniel said in two different chapters, he said, we are now, essentially to the Jews, we are now in the time of Gentile world dominion, when the focus of world events is not Israel anymore. It's going to be the Gentile nations. Israel's on the sidelines from here on out. And the first great world empire was Babylon, the head of gold. And following Babylon would come the Medes and the Persians and their world dominion. And following the dominion of the Medes and the Persians would come Alexander the Great and the Greeks. and following the Greeks would come the Roman Empire, and the Roman Empire would persist down to the end of time, and essentially some kind of an extension of the Roman Empire would exist until Messiah came as the great smiting stone to smite the great image of the beast that Nebuchadnezzar had in his dream. Remember all that? So we already had a little bit of a pretty good clue from Daniel. We'd been reading Daniel back there. We have a pretty good idea of how the course of history is going to go. We've also more recently been focusing on the return from the captivity. Ezra and Nehemiah and Esther and Zechariah and Malachi and Haggai. And this indeed is one of the first things that Cyrus makes possible when he becomes king. When the Persians come in, Daniel is praying. Daniel sees the 70 years is up. He prays to God that the Jews could go back to Babylon. And Cyrus says, sure, go back. And he sends them back under two men, Joshua and Zerubbabel. Remember, Joshua is a legitimate descendant of David. And so he is the legitimate heir to the throne of Israel, if there was a throne of Israel, except they're under foreign dominion now. And Joshua the high priest is a legitimate high priest in the line of Aaron. And Joshua and Zerubbabel will bring a bunch of the people back, not very many, and build the altar of the temple. And then what happened? They got lazy and went off to build their houses, and the temple construction stopped for 15 years until they were persuaded to get the temple done. And the temple's all done and running and functioning, so we have sacrifices going in Jerusalem again. And we have a remnant. The people who come back are more or less pliable and responsive to God and willing to listen to their teachers and their prophets. They're not as stubborn and hard-headed as their grandparents were before they exiled in Babylon. So that sounds like this is going to be a great golden new age for Israel. And there are three separate returns, if you remember, over a period of time of about 100 years. The first was under Zerubbabel and Joshua, 536. And then in 458, Ezra comes in. Remember Ezra? And then in 445, Nehemiah comes in. That's a sort of like a 100-year period of time. And the walls get built around Jerusalem, and Jerusalem gets repopulated, and there's a government set up. And who gets to be the governor of the whole area for a long period of time? Well, Nehemiah does. Nehemiah's the cupbearer of the king. And in your handout today, at the end I gave you the list of the rulers of the Persian period, starting with Cyrus. And in the middle is the correlation with events in the Bible. We had Dr. Thompson read for us the book of Esther. Esther was the wife of Xerxes, as far as we can be pretty sure. Xerxes is in there, and it's under Artaxerxes, his son, that we have Nehemiah and Malachi and the return of the people under Ezra. So there are the list of the kings. If you go on the internet, you can find something about these guys who are notable. As early as Artaxerxes, now these kings are expanding the Persian Empire as far and wide as they can. This is Persian world dominion. So they press their dominion down into Egypt and into India, and they're pushing over against the Greeks. And at this time period, Greece is a bunch of city-states, and they're not united together as a nation very much, but the wars between the Persians and the Greeks are very antagonistic to both sides. So you can sort of, knowing Daniel, you know what's going to happen next. The latter period of time of the Persian Empire is a period of sort of slow decadence and decline, which you'd expect out of a powerful empire that doesn't pay any attention to God. And Philip of Macedon comes along and gets the Greek city-states more or less united. The Greeks can be a formidable enemy of the Persians. So Philip doesn't last very long, and he dies, and his son, Alexander the Great, replaces him at age 19. And the next 13 years of the life of Alexander the Great are probably well known. There's a special running on the History Channel right now, I think, on this young man, Alexander the Great, who succeeds in overthrowing the entire Persian Empire.
Well, that's exactly what Daniel said would happen.
4 hours.
What's that?
4 hours.
4 hours long. Right.
Prior to the fall, when Alexander got into Persia, he himself was very taken by the Persian, the luxury of the Persian court, and by the oriental customs of Persia. However, already at this time, Greek influence, the influence of the Greek philosophers, like 400 BC, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, the whole culture of Greece is beginning to pervade the whole region already. We get a whole long period of time called Hellenization, in which the Greek language and the Greek culture permeates the whole known world. Even before the fall of Persia, you get this spreading influence of the Greeks. And it's obviously this is going to be the period of time of the Greek dominion over the whole world. So when Alexander the Great conquers the whole Persian Empire, dying in Babylon at the age of 33, in 322 BC, he's discouraged. He has no more worlds left to conquer. His whole life is fighting wars, and he has no place left to go. And he gets drunk and dies young, and then lives to see the empire that follows. But the influence now of Greece continues. Now the battles with Alexander the Great and the Persians are really interesting, and Alexander was an incredibly fine soldier, didn't hesitate to go right into the battle with his troops against incredible odds, and just sheer willpower defeated his enemies. He passed down through Israel and all the way to Egypt, and the Egyptians were not very happy with the Persians at that point, so the Egyptians welcomed Alexander the Great as a liberator, and they decided to make him one of their pharaohs and to make him a god, and he went down to the oasis, and the oracle there very wisely said that he was indeed God. Very wise when your conqueror comes in and they can be one of your men. And the Egyptians have a lot of gods to go around, so it's no big deal. So he's conquered all the way down to Egypt. On his way back from Egypt, we have that incident of him passing by Jerusalem and up the coast of Israel and discovering that the Jews have given their loyalty to the Persians. So he's going to go sack Jerusalem, if you remember. And we have this story from Josephus, which may or may not be accurate, in which the high priest Jaddua in Jerusalem gets the priests together and put on their robes and welcomes Alexander to the city and reads him the passage in Daniel that predicts exactly what he's going to do that Daniel had written. And in any case, however this story goes, Alexander spared Jerusalem and didn't destroy Jerusalem. He had no problem plundering everybody. He also had finally got Tyre and Sidon in 18 months, which Nebuchadnezzar tried to do for 7 years and failed. So he was quite unstoppable. When Alexander the Great came up north from Egypt, then he moved east through all of Turkey and Asia Minor and on and far into the east and all the way down to India. And that's Alexander the Great. So the immediate consequences of the Greek overrun of Israel are not great. Israel's more left alone for a little while. So during the whole Persian period, Israel has it pretty well off. They have to pay taxes and tribute to Persia. The kings in Persia are generally sort of favorable to the Jews as long as they pay their taxes and behave themselves. So you could say that the Persian period, in which the Persians are in charge of Israel, is a relatively quiet period. Now comes Alexander. If you get to Alexander, we're only 300 years B.C. about. Alexander dies. There's this quarreling among five of his generals, which results in the four of the generals ganging up against a guy named Antigonus and killing him, and then they divvy up the land between four generals. And the whole Greek Empire now gets subdivided into four parts. Remember? We only pay attention mostly to two parts, to Syria in the north and to Egypt in the south, because these are the two pieces of land that Israel happens to be in the middle of.
Did it get divided into 10? I thought it was about 5 to 10. Or are you just recognizing only the 5?
There were 10 cities, 10 divisions, yes.
Was the Syrian territory then much larger than the
Was?
Was the Syrian territory then much larger than the
Yes. And there's all kinds of little disputes over how big Syria, the Syrian territory is. And I was struck again by all the blood and violence in the Persian kings and in the Greek kings and all of the feuds. And as somebody pointed out this morning, nobody seems to have died a natural death in all this, these long periods of time. And there's all this fighting, internal and external. Now, for our biblical purposes, though, we enter into this long period of time of about 200 years in which the Seleucids in the north and the Ptolemies in the south, that are both Greek rulers, fight back and forth among each other, and Israel gets caught in the middle. So Israel now is not going to be necessarily in all good times. For the first 100 years or so, the Ptolemies have the main influence over Israel. And the second of these Ptolemies, Ptolemy Philadelphus, is a very benevolent guy. He's very impressed with the Jews. He asks for 70 scholars to come from Jerusalem, bringing the sacred books of the Bible down and having them setting up a nice place for them to translate the Hebrew scriptures into the Greek. And these rabbis come down and they each work on the translation and come up with this rendering of the Hebrew Bible into the Greek language, because we're in a period of Hellenization. Ptolemy's building the great library in Alexandria. He's collecting all the ancient wisdom. He wants all the ancient books in Greece so that we can disseminate Greek civilization. And so the Jewish Bible gets put into Greek. And we have that today as the Septuagint, LXX is the way it's usually abbreviated. And it's still a very important version of the Bible, and still referenced a lot, and you can find it on the internet or go buy a copy of it. And it's the Greek version of the Old Testament. I think the scholars did the five books of Moses first, and the rest of the Old Testament later, but we have the Septuagint. And integrated into the great library of the Greek civilization. Now, that library was the greatest, most wonderful library in the ancient world, largely destroyed later by the Arabs and by the other destructions in Alexandria. But there's a new library in Alexandria now, as you may know, as modern-day scholars have appreciated the wealth of that ancient library and attempted to build a new great library in its place. Alexander himself was buried in Alexandria at his own request in a gold casket. I remember going looking for it 20 years ago. Didn't find it then. His body seems to have disappeared in his tomb and all traces of the ancient library. But anyhow, so we have the Ptolemies treating the Jews favorably for, say, about 100 years. Now we get a guy up in the north called Antiochus. You can get your intertestamental mental chronology out here. Things are going to start going bad with the guy over on the left in the Seleucid's name, Ptolemy the Third. Antiochus the Third. And Antiochus the Third decides he'd like to have Palestine for himself and to kick out the Ptolemies who were pretty much controlling it. So he has a war in 217, which he loses, but by 198, he's pretty well pushed the Ptolemies out of Israel. So now the little piece of people of Israel now essentially have to pay tribute to the Seleucids in the north in Syria. The Seleucids have lined themselves up with Hannibal and gotten themselves in trouble with the Romans. The Roman civilization is beginning to get its act together now. The Romans are fighting the Punic Wars. They're not in exactly a great united empire, but they're getting things together, so that Rome is beginning to be a force to be reckoned with. And we know how that's going to turn out. We know that the Romans are soon going to replace the Greeks as the dominant world power in the Mediterranean. And that's going to come about essentially in this time period. Antiochus the Third dies, is replaced by his son Seleucus IV Philopater, Philopater, who is murdered. And that brings us to his son. Now the Romans were a little upset, so they always kept one of the Seleucid heirs over in Rome in sort of semi-prison status, where they could keep an eye on the successor to the throne. And Antiochus IV is this boy over in that the Romans are keeping in Rome, and they send him back and allow him to be king. And Antiochus IV Epiphanes becomes this very pivotal figure in the Old Testament, which I'm sure you already remember about him. He's called Epiphanes, which means the illustrious one, and the Jews, because he was so bad to the Jews, they call him Antiochus Epiphanes, which is a big insult. It means, I forgot what it means.
The madman.
The madman, that's it, the madman. He's the madman. Now, Antiochus IV does a couple of bad things. First of all, he notices that there's a legitimate high priest, Onias III, in Jerusalem, who's a legitimate priest in the line of Pharaoh. But another priest down there who does not have a claim to the priesthood, named Jason, pays a little money under the table to salute to Antiochus and buys the priesthood for himself. So we get the end of the Levitical priest. And that doesn't last very long because the brother of Jason and Menelaus pays more money under the table, takes treasures out of the temple, sends them up to Antiochus, and buys the priesthood out from under his brother, as his brother killed. So from now on, the priesthood in Israel is no longer a legitimate priesthood in the land of Levi. It's a purchased priesthood. And you buy that priesthood with money through some kind of arrangement. So we don't have a legitimate priest from that time on down. Antiochus thinks he's really somebody great, and he has two military campaigns in which he tries to take over Egypt by marching through Israel and marching all the way down to Egypt and to see if he can overthrow the Ptolemies, which he fails to do the first time. On the second trip down, the Jews in Jerusalem hear a rumor that he's been killed. Antiochus has been killed. And that causes a big celebration in Jerusalem, and Menelaus is in the middle of all this. And Antiochus gets news that they're rejoicing in Jerusalem because he's dead, but he isn't dead. And he comes back to Jerusalem in a very violent fit of temper, kills 40,000 Jews, takes the temple treasure, stops the worship in the temple, offers a pig, a sow, upon the altar, totally desecrates the temple, and shuts down the temple worship. And this is the event that's talked about in the New Testament, which we'll get to, God willing, in the weeks ahead, that Jesus spoke about the abomination of desolation, which had been predicted by Daniel the prophet. Daniel said this would happen. It would happen once in the Old Testament times, and it would happen yet one more time again in the future, in a distant day. Antiochus is a violent and cruel man. He hates the Jews. He wants to burn all copies of the Bible. He wants to stamp out the Jewish religion. And he's almost successful at it. So he is a tyrant over the people of Israel up until we get the rebellion against him by a man named Mattathias. Mattathias is a older, devout Jewish man. And Antiochus tries to compel him to bow down and worship him, and Mattathias refuses and starts a revolt against Antiochus. And it turns out being a successful revolt. It's a revolt called the Maccabean Rebellion, and it results in a period of independence for Israel for some years. And it takes 3 years before the Maccabeans are able to restore the temple worship. In fact, Daniel had said it would be 2,300 days that the sacrifices in the temple would stop, and that they would be restored at the end of 2,300 days. And sure enough, that's exactly the time the temple was refurbished, and all of the sacrifices were turned on again, and the date happened to be December 25. 25th of December, which today is still celebrated by the Jews as Hanukkah. Right? And that's this period of the Jews' restoration of the temple and the restoration of temple services with sacrifices and some kind of a functioning priesthood. Well, the fact that this was a period of independence doesn't last very long, Because now the power politics are going strong in the Middle East. The Ptolemies are still around. The Seleucids are up to no good. And the Romans have begun to get themselves involved. And a group of people called the Edomians and the Nabataeans. The Nabataeans have come down from Damascus and to overrun Jordan. And the Romans are beginning to get their empire together and beginning to expand the frontiers of their empire. So now Rome takes notice of this. Rome had taken notice of Antiochus Epiphanes' exploits in trying to conquer Egypt, and Pompey had come in 63 and said to Antiochus, stop it. Stop all this. And the Jews, caught in the middle of this, call on one party or another for help. And they finally, the Romans get invited in. The history of the Maccabees is very complicated. And I gave you a whole piece of paper on the Maccabees and the period of time that followed that. Some of you know more about this than I do, by a long ways. Because this brave, dedicated group of young men, brothers mostly, who are successful in restoring Jewish sovereignty, gradually deteriorate and become the Hasmonean dynasty. That's the kind of family name. And they are the ones that invite the Romans in, and the Romans bring in a man named Antipater, who is over in Idumea, and his sons, of one of whom is Herod the Great, becomes the king of Israel, and begins to rule, replace the rule in both the self-rule of the Jews and the self-rule of any interference from the Seleucids. So that gets to be the bloody period, but by 63 AD, the Romans essentially are in control of the Middle East and in control of Palestine, and gradually subduing then the remnants of the Greek Empire. Now, did I confuse that so badly that it's hopeless?
The Maccabees
are Jews who are, I give you a piece of paper that's got the family tree of the Maccabees, which starts with Mattathias, who died in 166, and then his sons, John, Simon, Judas Maccabeus, Eleazar, and Jonathan, and then the sons down all the way that are active in this revolt, and how that leads. Oh, this is the period of time of Cleopatra, and famous time, and how that ends up with Herod the Great, and how that turns into the dynasty of the Herods. Yeah.
So you're saying that Herod is derived from the Maccabees?
By marriage and by invitation. But Herod is himself an Idumean. He's a descendant of Esau. And Herod, of course, comes into office in Jerusalem. He gets in good with Caesar, gets himself promoted to be king over Israel. And in order to impress the Jewish people, because he's really a descendant of Esau, not a legitimate Jew, he goes into all these building projects and builds the Tomb of Abraham up into a nice building, and he puts buildings all over, and he rebuilds the temple rather lavishly and extravagantly. So that little small temple that the Zerubbabel had built becomes this big, magnificent building with the porticos and all the associated buildings, and a lot of gold again imported into the temple. So that's the temple that Jesus will be dedicated in, and that's the temple where he'll throw out the money changers twice. All right, now.
Which one has Felix's line?
Which one is which?
Felix.
Felix.
Any of these three has David's Felix? Descendants?
Yeah, down on the Herodians.
Which one? The one in the middle?
David's line.
David. King David.
Oh, there's nobody left legitimately in influence in Israel who's in the real line of David. By the time we get to the New Testament, the whole scene in Israel has changed rather radically. We don't have a legitimate king or a legitimate governor anymore. We have Roman overlords, and especially King Herod. We no longer have a legitimate priesthood. The priests are now all in office because they've been hired, they've been paid. They're paid priests. So they don't have any connection with the Levitical priest. The temple worship is still going on at the beginning of the New Testament. We have two huge major, essentially, religious political parties in Israel, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, a little minority group called Essenes that we know about from the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Pharisees are the conservative, old guard, hardcore, literal Bible interpretation fundamentalists. They are holding the line in what they think is Orthodox Jewish belief. They think that they are the protectors of the historic religion of Israel. They believe in the Bible literally. They believe in the supernatural. So they hold rigidly to the books of Moses, and they would convince everybody that they are the legitimate religious leadership of the country. However, by the time of Jesus, as you know, they've frozen themselves into such a rigid legalism that Jesus has his most scorching words of condemnation for the Pharisees. They're self-righteous, and they're legalistic, and their religion is one of externals totally. But we get that party in power. They cannot act independently of the Romans, but they cozy up against the Romans and pretty well govern the country religiously, except for the Sadducees. And the Sadducees now are Jews who have been heavily influenced by the Greek culture and philosophy. They like modern ideas. They like change. They think that we've got to keep up with the times, so they're adopting in Greek ideas, Greek values, liberalizing the Jewish religion, and still calling themselves Jews and still claiming to be legitimate Jews. And we have now the conflict between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And many of the questions that come from these people at Jesus are directed at trying to put him on the spot and test him. Because neither of these groups is particularly in tune with the real God after all. That means that the spiritual life in Israel is at a very low ebb when Jesus shows up on the scene. And you know from the Gospels that Jesus meets some godly priests, he meets some godly individuals. He's running on to people in the land of Israel who are faithful to the God of Israel. There's a remnant there. But on the surface, it's pretty bleak. That means it's gone way downhill since Ezra, Malachi, Nehemiah, and Esther, which is where we left it off. When we left it off, there was a healthy, functioning priesthood and a worshiping priesthood and people studying the Bible and the Levitical priests teaching the Bible, and we had genuine worship. And that's all gone away in 400 years. We have, however, that Greek influence has spread pervasively over the whole known world, and the Bible is now available in Greek. The Old Testament's available in Greek, and that sort of sets the stage for the coming of the Messiah right on time. But nobody's expecting him. And what does he do when he shows up? He shows up and he picks disciples who are, he didn't go to the Bible school and ask for their 10 top students. And he didn't go to the seminary and say, I want your 10 most godly students to be my disciples. He went out and picked non-believers who were ordinary unlettered fishermen, led them to himself and taught them and trained them and raised up the disciples who would follow him. So that's kind of the setting for the New Testament. That's where the New Testament opens. It opens then with, really it opens with the announcement that John the Baptist is there heralding, telling the whole nation to repent because the Messiah has at long last showed up. The Messiah that has been Israel's hope all down through the years. That's kind of big. I hope that helps a little bit to see how the stage on which the New Testament opens.
When did the Jews lose track of which tribe they belonged to?
Most of the Jews, many of the Jews today still know the tribes they came from.
So the Maccabees?
Those, for example, they oftentimes carry names, Simeon, Simon, Judah, to this day. After the Holocaust, after World War II, the Jews in Israel and around the world began to take a renewed interest in their genealogies. And most Jews, many Jews today in Israel, will be able to tell you a lot about their own lineage, and they take a lot of pride in that.
But what about Maccabees? Which tribe
is it? Mattathias, I don't know. Judah, probably. Somebody might know. Preston?
Well, since the Sadducees and Pharisees, has there ever been a real revival of authentic Judaism?
No. During the Babylonian captivity, and in this time period, is when the Jewish Bible scholars generate the Talmud and the Mishnah and Maccabees is written and a whole bunch of extraneous documents that we have. In the Catholic Bible, you'll find a bunch of these in between the Old Testament and the New Testament. If you get a copy of the Babylonian Talmud, you'll find a little verse of the Bible in the middle and then all these commentaries around the outside. And all those things that... This is the time period also of the synagogue in which the Jews in remote areas are gathering together in assemblies called synagogues. With the president, we have synagogues in this area. If you would go visit an Orthodox synagogue on Friday night as a Gentile, you'd be quite welcome. And you'd find perhaps a cantor singing some psalms, and you'd find maybe inspirational message drawn from the Old Testament, and you'd find the people polite and friendly, glad to welcome you in most part, for the most cases, in the more Orthodox synagogues, and that's worthwhile to go see them. In Israel today, there are Messianic Jews who are looked down on and not treated as legitimate, maybe 50,000, and those Jews confess Jesus, but they're at odds with all of the secular Jews. Most of Israel today is secular. Now, you have a comment?
I too, actually. The first is, you said that the Old Testament, so was it only the Pentateuch, or was it more books written in translated to Greek by the time we reached the New Testament?
I found two different statements on this. I found out that the Septuagint, one source I read said that the Septuagint was originally only the five books of Moses, and that it was Origen and the early Christian scholars that completed the translation of the rest of the Old Testament into Greek. And I've seen both. And I don't know. And the source of how the Pentateuch was written is a little fuzzy.
Right.
The main idea would be that it didn't take very long to do the translation. It had 70 scholars, and it was a good translation. Probably find more on Glenn Miller's webpage. You can look up. There's a half a dozen webpages on them. Did you have a second comment?
Oh, the second comment was in Israel there are of course the Messianic Jews. Then there's also a section just north of Jerusalem where there's an entire community that believes that Israel should not be a nation. These are very Orthodox. You remember that? They were walking around with black coats and hats, and these people believe in the old Jerusalem, the old,
Hasidic Jews.
They're north of they are north of Jerusalem. There's like four or five blocks of
If you go to Israel today and you go and you look at the cross section of religious Jews, remember that be religious in Israel is already to be in a minority.
Right.
But these minorities are split up. Some of it is based on what ghetto they came out of in Poland or Russia or whatever. And so they may be very strict. Some of these Jews are very strict, very observant. They don't want you driving through their part of the town on the Sabbath. Some of them live in little villages. Some of them won't participate in the military. Some of them will. Some of them think that the temple should be rebuilt. Some think the Messiah will have to rebuild the temple. Most of them are reasonably friendly if you don't antagonize them, so they're not. They're just, it's strange. Israel today has more pluralism, I think, than almost any other nation in the world. The Jews have come back from all countries of the world, and they brought all their subcultures, whether from Asia or from the West, and this big melting pot. I think half of the people in Israel are immigrants. They've moved there from other lands.
Yeah.
The Hebrew language has only been restored in the last 150 years. The Hebrew language has more or less disappeared up until the current restoration. Half of the Jews in Israel have been born there now, Sabras, and those Jews don't much care about where their forefathers came from. They have their roots in the land, interest in archaeology, and interest in their historical past, and why are we here, and why did God save us, and what is our future. So they have a lot of Bible schools in Israel. I think the last time I counted, there were a couple hundred thousand young men who study in these Bible schools. And that's enough to make 144,000 evangelists if you got them out of the Old Testament into the New. Bright and alert. And anyhow, so What else did we miss here? We got synagogues. Yeah. Masada, this comes, we'll get a little bit after this. Jesus grew up in Nazareth, started his ministry at about age 30, taught for about 3 years, was initially accepted by the crowds, later rejected by the crowds, finally put to death by his own people, came into Jerusalem as a legitimate king and was rejected. Now what happens when the nation as a whole rejects the legitimate Messiah on the day that he shows up? Is that offensive to God? Yeah, it is. Gets them thrown out of the land for 2,000 years. They don't leave readily. The second temple is destroyed by the Romans under Titus in AD 90. Titus is a compassionate man. He tries to negotiate with the Jews. Look, I don't want to tear down your temple. Let's sign a peace treaty. And the Jews are all infighting in the city and at each other's throats again. And Jerusalem gets destroyed all over again, second time. The Jews still rebel. It's just Bar Kokhba, I think 135 AD, that they rebel to the point the Romans crack right down on them, drive them all out of the land, and that's at the time of the Jews up to the fortress of Masada are annihilated, and they become the last bastion of Jews holding out against the Romans. The Romans would leave the Jews alone as long as the Jews behaved themselves and paid their taxes, but the Jews had a habit of not liking that very much and always being very rebellious. And the Jews, two Jews, it means three opinions. So the Jews love to fight against one another. To this day, you go to Jerusalem and you'll find all these Jews arguing with each other and having shouting matches, and they're the best of friends. And they don't want to come home and be that way here.
Talking back to the group of Jews, would you say that the Messianic Jews are the real
Jews? That's a hard question. Are the Messianic Jews really the remnant, or are they part of the church? I think for the most part, when a Jew becomes a follower of Jesus today, he or she is most always in the church. They're almost always brothers and sisters in Christ. We have Messianic congregations in this area, a lot of them in Florida and New York. They're just a little strange because they have Jewish folk dancing on Friday night and worship in Jewish songs. You can visit them, and they're fellow Christians, and I think they're probably in the body of Christ. Now, Paul in Romans says that even now there is a remnant chosen by grace in Israel. So I think there are believing Jews in Israel who are not in the church, but who are in part of Israel, and that's a hard problem to deal with. In other words, among those Orthodox Jews, are there Jews there that are really loyal to Jehovah in the Old Covenant sense and a personal relationship with God? Probably there are. Well, they would say they were, yeah. They would say they were.
Do we consider the Americans as Jews?
Now, what happens when the Jews, most of the Jews in the world that were taken off to Babylon or taken off in the northern captivity, have become assimilated? That means they've been secularized, that they've blended into the culture around pretty much. God has protected the Jews in their dispersion. Some of them meet in synagogues. Some of them are very observant, some are slightly observant, and some are totally secular. A lot of them end up great doctors, lawyers, scientists. That's just God's way of blessing their forefathers by making them great, outstanding men in out of all proportion to their small numbers in the world. What do we have? Under 20 million Jews in the whole world today? So they're... If you meet a Jew at work, he or she may have... will probably not identify right away with your Christian values. You may notice that they are in a way a little different. It's hard for them to completely throw away their Jewishness. One of the neatest things is to know Christian Jews, Jews that know Jesus, completed Jews. I always envy them because it's more natural in a way for them to know the Lord than for us Gentiles. But we're all one big family together in the body of Christ.
Now, he resembles that. The king, the Herod, he is a descendant of Esau.
Yes.
So is that also considered as a Jew?
No.
I mean, Esau is a Jew.
Remember Jacob and Esau? Remember Malachi? Jacob have I loved, but Esau have I hated, so that Jacob becomes the man Israel, who's the father of the Jewish people. Esau becomes his antagonist. The Edomites. The Edomites go live down around Petra and Basra in southern Jordan and become enemies of Israel. And they're also destroyed. We saw in Malachi that they eventually begin to die out. Obadiah talks about that. And so by the time of Christ, the Edomites are almost extinct as a racial group. But the Edomites picture for us the flesh. Flesh isn't extinct yet.
There was a question earlier about the Jewish people recognize the tribe that they came from. Most of the records were destroyed in 70 AD when
yes.
the temple was destroyed.
Yes.
So they can't really
they can't. There's some genetic tests right now that I think have identified Ethiopians as genuinely Jewish, and so some of the genetic tests now can tell you which tribe you came from.
Tell it from the nose.
Are there any counterparts today to the Pharisees and the Sadducees?
Yes, right here in Palo Alto, there are counterparts of the Pharisees. Well, the Pharisees, if there are some of the Jews in Israel can be very self-righteous and very opinionated, but they don't have a lot of clout. What you get in Israel is all of these little Jews have their own favorite, religious groups have their own favorite rabbi. And they follow the leadership of that rabbi, and he's almost like the Messiah. And so they, but they're small, each little group is small in number. So they don't have the kind of united front that the Pharisees had.
So the Hasidim didn't derive in any way from the Pharisees, that as soon as Jerusalem was destroyed, all the things started to disappear.
Yeah, life becomes in the synagogues and in the exile. Because very few Jews lived in the Holy Land for a long, long period of time after about 200, 150 AD, mostly empty.
To what extent were the people at the time when Jesus shows up really following the Pharisees or the Sadducees? Because they all went after John the Baptist, right? And the Pharisees and Sadducees kind of didn't know what to make of him. And it sounded like most of the people didn't seem like they really lined up with the Pharisees.
That's true. Yeah, that, I think the average person in Israel when Jesus came had no particular allegiance to the Pharisees or the Sadducees. Their political clout was in Jerusalem. They had synagogues throughout the land. I suppose the average person would be as indifferent to them as most people in America are indifferent to the church. Maybe you go to the synagogue, but it's empty, doesn't mean anything. And so when Jesus appeals mostly to the masses, and that's where he gets his crowd, the Pharisees and Sadducees look on at first and they're curious, but become hostile because he's so threatening. The crowds are disappointed because Jesus doesn't throw the Romans out and bring in the kingdom, and he wants to meddle with people on the inside and change their lives and get them to be different on the inside. And that doesn't ever sit well with us any time.
Why is God silent?
Why is God silent? Why was God silent for 400 years? Why does he seem to be so silent? Why does he take so long to do all these things? Why has it been 2,000 years for the Jews before they will see their final chapter?
I know a conservative Jew whose last name was Cohen, and just a footnote on the genealogy aspect. He underscored what Bill said in terms of most of them not knowing. Said, but those that are of whose lineage in the priesthood do know that.
That's true.
But the other tribes not so.
Especially the priests. If you go to Jerusalem today, I've mentioned before the Temple Institute, the rabbi that runs, one of the rabbis there, Rabbi Haim Richmond's a friend of mine. He's a Brooklyn Orthodox Jew, so he speaks with a Brooklyn accent. delightful man. Very conversant in American lifestyle, but very devout in his Jewishness. They have built all the sacred vessels for the temple, their temple, and at many billions of dollars to get ready, and they have all the plans ready for the third temple, which would be the Orthodox temple. Working alongside of them is a rabbinical yeshiva, a school for priests, and all of the students who are training to be priests are Levites. They have to be a Levite to get in that school. So they're in training right now. So if the third temple was built next week, we'd have a functioning Jewish priesthood with legitimate Levites don't have to know the Lord, but you have to be from the tribe of Levi. Yes?
How could they know that they are from that tribe when all the records were destroyed? Just through oral tradition?
Oral tradition and through research and through all the genealogy. They're much more into genealogy than most of us are. Family trees. Yeah.
Do you have a time frame in mind that they are thinking?
Whenever the Muslims get off of the Temple Mount through earthquake, fire, flood, or famine, they will put the temple up. Quick.
But it's in a different place.
Yeah, we have to find out where it belongs.
It's sheer speculation, remember, but nothing makes you hungrier than a really long fast. And I got a suspicion that for 400 years people are wondering in the back of their head where God is, and more likely to pay attention. So these kept real hungry, so that when Jesus comes on the scene, there's a general anticipation.
Who are the people that welcome Jesus when he's dedicated at the temple lot? Simon? There's a couple of old people, old gentlemen that now I can die because I've seen the Messiah. And Anna, the prophetess, yes. So there are those that recognize the Messiah is there even when they see the baby Jesus. I guess maybe the real issue is how do you get along in your Christian life when it's routine, when nothing much is happening, in the day-by-day battle? Can you keep Jesus in the center of your life and priorities? Can you keep busy with the work of the kingdom, even if it's discouraging, even if things get worse, even if we're in hard times? Can you be faithful to the God of Israel because he always keeps his promises? That might be the lesson of the silent years. What is the general trend of the Old Testament? Downhill? Doesn't have to be that way for any of you as individuals. It can be steady and growing and learning with the help of God's grace.
Could it also be the unification of the Greek language?
Yes, now you see what God's done by letting Greek be the universal language of the world. It means that when the New Testament's written in Greek, it can be spread to all the nations, and God then brings Messiah at the exact right time in history, which is the timing of God is never off. That's the appointed time. Doesn't matter that Israel's in a very low state. It's time for Messiah to come, and the message of Messiah will go to the whole world. And the Greek language facilitates that.
Roman road.
Next week, God willing, we will take up the rapture, which many deny is going to ever happen, and then move on into the Olivet Discourse and Revelation. God willing. Now, if the rapture were to come today or before next week, we won't have the class. Father, thank you for this hour today in this very complicated period of history, which is confusing and hard to stumble through. And I pray, Father, that we might have an idea of how you work in history, of your patience, of your timing, of the faithfulness of your promises, the God who is 100% dependable and reliable and who never fails. And you do test our patience sometimes, but you're running the universe and not us. Help us to be faithful to you and obedient, whether a lot of things are happening or not very many. Just help us in the day-to-day. And with the holidays coming and the world goes a little crazy around us, we pray that we can be stable, lights, and just like at Hanukkah, lights in the dark world. And you watch over our lives and use us. In the name of Jesus.
Thank you.
Just a couple. That's great.